and try a little fish instead.
Everybody.
Catfish for supper.
News. Hello. The US Secretary of State has accused Russia and China of cynically vetoing an American draft resolution on Gaza at the UN Security Council. It had called for an immediate ceasefire linked to the release of hostages. Antony Blinken said the text had widespread support from most other countries, but Moscow and Beijing said it put conditions on a pause in the fighting and failed to clearly oppose an Israeli offensive in Rafah. Mr. Blinken told reporters he did not understand the objections.
We were trying to show the international community's sense of urgency about getting a ceasefire tied to the release of hostages, something that everyone, including the countries that vetoed the resolution, should have been able to get behind. The resolution, of course, also condemned Hamas. It's unimaginable why countries wouldn't be able to do that.
Mr. Blinken was speaking after a visit to Israel. The Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, told him he would go ahead with a planned ground assault on Rafah, even without US backing. The Israeli leader said such action was the only way to defeat Hamas. Russia has said it launched massive strikes on Ukraine's energy infrastructure to punish Kyiv for attacking its border regions. The drone and missile strikes are believed to have been the largest, targeting Ukrainian power facilities since the start of the war. The bombardment hit a vast dam, killing at least five people and leaving more than a million without electricity. Here's Vitaly Shevchenko from BBC Monitoring.
Kharkiv, the second largest city in Ukraine, seems to be worst hit. Zaporizhia, the biggest hydropower dam in Ukraine, was hit. There's no immediate threat of breach, but it caught fire. I spoke to my friends from Zaporizhia and they described how the whole buildings were shaking. One of them spoke of an Armageddon in Zaporizhia.
Kenya's state-backed Human Rights Commission says government officials ignored credible reports that could have prevented the deaths of more than 400 people linked to a doomsday cult. The cult leader, Paul McKenzie, is in prison, awaiting trial for murder, manslaughter, terrorism and child abuse. And Soy reports from Nairobi.
The commission's report reveals chilling details about the doomsday cult. It says an armed militia enforced the fasting to death and would strangle or clobber those who resisted or tried to flee. The militia then buried the dead in shallow mass graves in Shakahola Forest near the Kenyan coast. The cult's leader was first reported to police in 2017. He was arrested, charged, but then released. The commission says the police also reprimanded a former member of the cult who raised the alarm on social media. The BBC has contacted the Cabinet Secretary for Interior for comment.
This is the latest world news from the BBC. A merger involving Donald Trump's social media company has been approved, providing a potential boost to the finances of the former president as he struggles with huge legal bills. Shareholders at a publicly traded shell company voted to merge with Trump Media. The deal values his stake at about $3 billion. The International Organization for Migration says a mass grave has been found in Libya, containing the bodies of at least 65 people. It believes those who died were migrants being smuggled through the desert towards the Mediterranean. The circumstances of their deaths and their nationalities are still unknown. The Libyan authorities are investigating. Final campaign rallies have been taking place in Senegal ahead of the delayed presidential election on Sunday. It follows weeks of political turmoil. President Macky Sall, who's been in power since 2012, is barred from running again. The BBC's James Copnell, who's in Dakar, says a second round of voting is likely to be needed.
There are almost 20 candidates and there are some pretty big names in there, broadly divided into the continuity and change camps, if you like. So it's considered by most observers unlikely that we would get victory in the first round. We may well head to a second one. And that brings up its own issues because President Macky Sall can't run again. His term of office finishes on the 2nd of April, but we are very unlikely to have a winner before then. So we're possibly heading towards another period of uncertainty in Senegal.
A prominent opposition leader in India has been remanded in custody following his arrest for alleged corruption. Earlier, Arvind Kejriwal, the head of the local government in Delhi, appeared in court in the capital to challenge his arrest. Hundreds of people held protests on Friday to back Mr. Kejriwal. His supporters describe his arrest as a political conspiracy orchestrated by the governing BJP. BBC News.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Just Coffee, Madison's Fair Trade Roasting Cooperative. Just Coffee buys fair trade coffee to ensure equitable conditions for coffee grower cooperatives around the world and roasts locally in small batches. More information at 204-9011 or on the web at justcoffee.coop.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Five Nines, a locally owned cloud service provider of enterprise-level IT infrastructure consulting, hosting, and management services. On the web at 59s.com. Phone number 512-1000.
6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. No power frequency.
No change without struggle. No one in power ain't giving up nothing. No change without struggle. No one in power.
WORT 89.9 FM, listener-sponsored community radio, Madison, Wisconsin.
And hello, welcome to A Public Affair. I am Esti Dinor, first order of the day today. I forgot to thank those of you who donated and pledged the 2 weeks prior to our show and to the station. Our show did very well. Thanks to you, we exceeded our goal both weeks. I am so grateful to you. Thank you so much for supporting us. I believe the station made its goal too. So appreciate hearing from you and apologies for forgetting it last week. And today we have a two-part show. We will be talking later with Ralph Nader about his estimate that so far actually 200,000 Palestinians or so have been killed in Gaza. We'll find out why he thinks so, and we'll talk about several other things. But we are starting with Marjorie Kelly, a distinguished senior fellow at the Democracy Collaborative, a nonprofit working to catalyze the creation of a democratic economy. She is a leading theorist in democratic economy design, including next generation enterprise, place-based impact investing, and a next system of capital. And we are talking with her today about her book, Wealth Supremacy: How the Extractive Economy and the Biased Rules of Capitalism Drive Today's Crises. Thank you so much, Marjorie, for joining us today.
Yes, thanks for having me, Esti.
And it looked like you liked our motto, no change without struggle, no one in power ain't giving up nothing.
I was smiling when you were playing that. It's wonderful.
It speaks to your issues, I think, doesn't it?
It does, you know, and I wanted to say I really love your sponsors too. They're co-ops and they're locally owned. That's
yes,
that's the economy we need. It's so great. I love Madison.
Yeah. Oh, you know us. You know Madison.
I lived in Madison for 10 years.
Oh.
back in the 1980s. Yeah, I used to be on the board of the Willie Street Co-op.
Okay, that's when I came to town too. So, what was I wanting? I don't know. I don't remember what that brought into my mind. It'll come back. But let's start talking then about your book. And first question is, what do you mean when you say extractive economy? Are you talking just about, which is not just, but about an economy based on the extraction of fossil fuels, etc.? Or is it more than that? What is an extractive economy?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's more than that. Really, I'm talking about financial extraction and the idea that our whole economy, which is, of course, a capitalist economy, it's centered on capital, and its whole aim is for capital, which is another name for wealth, to extract as much as possible from the rest of us. So it's an extractive economy.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about financialization. What is that, and how does it manifest?
This is a really important concept, and economists have been warning us about financialization for decades. It's very well documented, and yet it's very little known. It's an emergency really as large as climate change. And what it's about is that in order for wealth to grow, it grows often through extraction. You know, back when I was a kid in the 1950s, Esty, the financial sphere of, you know, stocks, bonds, debts of various kinds, so financial assets as a whole, were roughly equal to gross domestic product. And that's just, you know, that's the flows of income and spending. It's the real economy. So, but today, financial assets are five times GDP, five times the real economy, and yet it's built for the whole thing to grow. And where that leads is to financialization. So you have, you know, to debt on the backs of families, you have companies throwing workers out of work so that they can put more money to the bottom line. So you have various, you know, Exxon refuses to deal with climate change because it wants to keep its share price up. So there are all these ways that a financialized economy is destructive and is damaging. And it's been very well documented, and it's an emergency. And it's, you know, at our organization, we're trying to point to that and say, we need to start talking about that.
Mm-hmm. So when you say that financial assets are five times the GDP, mm-hmm. what does that mean? Whose financial assets? What does it mean?
that's a really great question. And you know, I liken this in a way to climate change. I mean, some of us remember Al Gore's movie Inconvenient Truth, and there are all these charts and graphs, and you know, so it took a little while to get our heads around it, but once you get it, it's, you know, too many GHG emissions. So financialization is kind of similar. It can seem complicated, but it's really simple. So we have financial assets are five times GDP. So what's up there? Who owns that? Well, about half of it is owned by wealthy people, right? And we mean, a tiny, tiny handful, 10, 20 people own roughly half of those financial assets. And so, you know, while we're all struggling to pay debts and workers are being thrown out of work in mass layoffs because they have to improve the bottom line, the companies say they do, really what we're doing is we're sacrificing in order for the assets of a few wealthy people to keep growing.
Mm-hmm. So that suggests to me, and tell me if I'm wrong, that these assets that are held by these few handfuls, maybe, of extremely wealthy people is more than the GDP of many countries in the world. Is that correct?
Absolutely. That's absolutely true. It's hard to get our heads around how much wealth these people have, and yet however much they have, it has to grow every quarter and every year. Those are the rules of investing, and that leads inevitably to financialization.
Mm-hmm. So that means that any one of these people have tremendous power. And I think Elon Musk maybe is the one that shows it the most, right? He helped Ukraine first, and then he decided to withhold his help and, you know, help the Russians. He's trying, or, you know, maybe succeeding in getting involved with Israel and no doubt many other nefarious things. Do these people generally seek also political power with that money that they have?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the vast majority of political contributions are made by just a few hundred families. So most of the money in politics is from highly wealthy people. And then, of course, there's corporate lobbying and corporate donations. And, you know, as we think about corporations, we think of them as objects that are owned by shareholders. And something like 89% of the stock market is owned by the wealthiest 10%. So even with corporate power, you're really talking about serving the needs of the wealthy.
Mm-hmm. So going back to financialization, again, I'm still trying to know if I understand it correctly. That means that indeed, or, you know, at least the way it manifests is that very few people have a lot of money and their goal is to continue accumulating more money. And that means that the rest of us don't have.
Yeah, that's right. Not only that we don't have it, but that it's actually being extracted from us. Mm-hmm. I work at the Democracy Collaborative, and we commissioned some work from three international economists on financialization. And they showed in very stark terms that the financial sector is where inequality is created. So the problem is not just that wealth is unequal. The problem is that growing, the whole process of growing that wealth extracts from others, which is most of us. And so that's a really missing idea in our economy. We think that wealth just grows. It just falls from the sky, you know, pristine and unblemished. No, it doesn't. But there's an underside to wealth that is ugly, and it's causing a lot of crisis. Our inability to deal with climate change, rising rents, mass layoffs, low wages, all of these things can be traced back to financialization.
Mm-hmm. So these are some of the ways it is extracted, and we already talked about basically wealthy people financing politicians and therefore get the political power to continue their financialization or to continue extracting mm-hmm. money. What other ways is the money extracted from us?
Well, let's talk about debt for a minute. People are struggling under credit card debt, under mortgage debt, which has become very unaffordable. Debt of all kinds. You know, when I owe something, somebody else possesses that debt. That's an asset for them. So that debt represents income for them. And this is particularly onerous when it comes to developing nations. Developing nations are really struggling under massive debt. And, you know, and there are some wonderful examples of forgiving debt. And this is part of a movement to definancialize our economy or democratize our economy. You know, there's a group called RIP Medical Debt. And you can buy debt for like a penny on the dollar. Medical debt that's you know, hasn't been collectible. This group buys it for a penny on the dollar and then just forgives that debt. And this is also happening with college debt. So it's an example of how we can start to reverse financialization.
Yeah. You say that there are cultural and political processes and attitudes by which persons of wealth accumulate and maintain prestige, privilege, and power that others lack. So what are these cultural and political processes and attitudes?
Yeah, this is what I call wealth supremacy. And it's a deliberate echo of white supremacy. I mean, we know that white supremacy is not legitimate in the same way that, you know, sexism or male supremacy is not legitimate. Well, this is a third form of bias. It's a bias toward wealthy people. And it says, you know, wealthy people matter more than other people. I mean, and it's embedded really in our language, which is, you know, feminist scholars tell us a lot about how language carries bias, and we talked about mankind or things like that. But so with economic language, we talk about someone's net worth, right? And that tells us that person is worth more than the rest of us. Well, that is a very biased view. And then we talk about deadbeats. I mean, people who are, you know, thrown out in mass layoffs, have low income, they're struggling to pay, and they're cast as deadbeats, which is highly biased.
Yeah, and even the word rich itself, right? Rich flavor, rich color, rich sounds good.
Yes, you're right. That's right. And then you have a poor attitude.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Huh, interesting. And you say that capitalism can continue to operate without hindrances because we see the world through an invisible lens of capital bias. So what is that invisible lens beyond what we've already mentioned?
Yeah. Well, for example, what's the leading paper of economics? It's the Wall Street Journal. It's not called the Labor Journal. Mm. It's not called the Middle Class Well-Being Journal. It's the Wall Street Journal. And so whether stocks and bonds are going up or down, that's considered a measure of success in the economy. Also, business schools teach that the purpose of management is to maximize gains for shareholders. And again, that's the wealthy few. So they're basically saying that all businesses exist to make the wealthy more wealthy. And we take another one is, I call it the myth of corporate governance. And it's the idea that workers are not members of the corporation. A worker can go to a company for 40 years, make its product, you know, keep that place running, and they don't have a vote. They don't have a claim on the wealth they create. They don't have a say. A hedge fund manager can hold stock for 15 minutes. They have a vote. They have a say. So that workers are disenfranchised and dispossessed.
Yeah. So is there a bias that I should look for in myself? Are there biases that we all share and we don't even know about that? Because, you know, my life has been really, like I think most people's lives, a journey of exploration and of realization, right? I was told this and that, and that's what I believe, and until a certain age when I started looking into it and eventually, you know, discovered a lot of biases that I was holding within myself. What is the bias about wealth and why it's okay?
Yeah, this is a really good question. I think you're right that we hold these biases in ourselves when we look to wealthy people as some kind of rock stars or heroes, or when we judge ourselves when we have low income, or when we're unemployed and we judge ourselves as personal failures, when really the system is actively biased against workers and against labor income. It's really trying to suppress labor income. So it's very much like, you know, feminists taught us, you know, blame the victim. We tend to blame the victim when your life is not going well financially. You think it's your fault. And another thing I think is when we really judge the success of our lives by how much wealth we have. There's nothing wrong with wanting to have some assets and some security. There's nothing wrong with that. But you know, trying to do better than your neighbors or thinking, I remember there was a young woman who started a company and wanted to be a billionaire. I mean, that's the wrong reason to start a company. So I think we can mislead ourselves about where happiness lies and where satisfaction lies if we're pursuing doing a job that we hate, but it makes a lot of money. You know, maybe that's not the right choice.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Marjorie Kelly. We're talking about her book, Wealth Supremacy, How the Extractive Economy and the Biased Rules of Capitalism Drive Today's Crisis. You are welcome to join us. She will be with us only until 40 minutes after the hour. 608-256-2001, extension 9, or you can join us on social media at War Talk on, I'm learning to say X, I suppose that's what it is nowadays, or a public affair on Facebook. So let's go through the crises that you say are the result of what we have been talking about. We talked a little about income inequality and economic injustice. What would you like to add to that?
Let's talk a little bit more about what I call the war on workers. There's research showing that so many white working class people, working class people of all colors, but particularly I think white people are the point I'm trying to make here, have experienced mass layoffs. And that is driving them to the right. It's leaving them vulnerable to blaming immigrants or blaming people of color. And so the crisis of democracy is driven in part by the war on workers, which is leaving workers looking for a scapegoat from who to blame. And we never think to blame the wealthy as the cause. And then, of course, also how the wealthy are capturing government through campaign donations. And you look at the hard right, and behind these think tanks that are driving it, there's billionaire dark money. So the crisis of democracy is one very big crisis, and that's driven by financialization, and of course our inability to deal with climate change. There are shareholders who filed a resolution to Exxon saying, you need to create a plan to bring down carbon emissions, and the company was so enraged it sued this little company that filed this shareholder resolution. So they're enraged by the idea that they should ever have to reduce production because that would reduce their share price. So almost everywhere you turn, if you dig into the root causes of these crises, you see excess financial wealth and this need to keep that growing. You see that is what's going on.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller for you, Marjorie. Hi, John, you're on the air.
Hi. Yes, hi. You know, it's not a strong counter argument, but it's one I hear all the time, is that there's, you know, middle class and workers really, there's some advantages to this financialized economy through their retirement funds, 401ks, the workers and teachers in Wisconsin do quite well with their retirement investments, with their annuities, with this kind of financialized economy. I wonder what your comment is on that. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, it's a great comment. It's true that we're all entangled with this financialized economy. You know, my wife and I have some assets, and we want to use them in retirement. And it's true, pension funds, firefighters, teachers rely on these pension funds. And all of that is dependent on the system as it is. And yet, when you look at this, there are large investors, for example, that are invested in private equity. And private equity is, these are funds that are invest in private companies. They're not publicly traded. They're private companies, but they're buying up newspapers and basically squeezing them so they go out of business. And they're buying up homes for the elderly and reducing staffing costs and driving up illness for these people in these homes. And there's research that shows that. So we look at these numbers of our portfolios returns and we think, oh yes, those numbers are good. Higher numbers are better. And we don't look at what's being done to get those numbers and where there's being extraction. So we need to find our way into this. You know, for example, there are wealthy people. There's a group called Patriotic Millionaires. I love this group. And they're saying we need to tax the wealthy. So we need to look at ways of how to find our way into unbundling financialization so that the middle class and pension funds can be fine. And yet the whole thing needs to be, the burden needs to be reduced.
Mm-hmm. And we have another caller for you. Douglas, you're on the air.
Hello. I would just like to say that I agree with your guest wholeheartedly in that in our culture, we should all be dressed as dollar bills because that's all we are in a consumer culture. Mm. And I've often said that capitalism is an oppressive system. If you're on the wrong line, the side of that line, you are put down every single day of your life as a worker. And and we wonder why people get pushed over the edge. And I think this is one of the things that pushes people over the edge. And the most depressing, lastly, the most depressing thing I've ever read is out of a book of ancient history, is that since humans have civilized, there's been haves and have-nots. And I'll take any comments off the air. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate those comments. I think it's true that most workers are being pushed to the edge all the time. Whenever I'm in the car with Uber or Lyft drivers, I always talk to them about how they're treated by the company. I mean, Uber takes 40% of every ride. 40%. That's ridiculous. And yet these riders have to pay their own gas and their own insurance and the deterioration of their cars. So companies are always trying to push risk onto workers and push low income onto workers so as to increase income to capital. And we take that as so much of a norm. It's really important that we start recognizing that's really what's happening. That is what is causing the squeeze on middle class and working class lives.
Mm-hmm. And I want to add to what Douglas said, that we are even more so assets, you know, just us individuals are assets, especially with our online culture now and the way data is collected about or are collected about all of us all the time. And people make money off of us just basically being online.
Yeah, that's right. Our identities are monetized and the money goes to Facebook and these other big tech companies. Yeah, that's right. And it's you know, the big capital is out there to own the gene code, wanting to own the gene code. Yeah. There's even a move to monetize what are called ecosystem services, which includes water and pollination and all, anything that can be monetized, they will seek to own it and extract from it. And it's going to get worse until we name it and call it out. And that's why I call it in my book, I call it wealth supremacy. Because yeah. I think it really helps us see what's going on, that it's about benefiting a few. And that's not true to us as a democracy.
Yeah. Well, we have yet another caller for you. Jeremiah, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. I've been a little bit sick for a week, so I apologize if I'm a little soft-spoken. I think this is a wonderful conversation, and I think to add to it, we have to go back to about a month. Shelley Pittman had a public affair on Monday where she talked with Astra Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
And Astra Taylor co-founded the Debt Collective.
Mm,
it's the union of debtors. And so I think that I would love for everybody to search for Astra Taylor, just an amazing voice. And Shelley Pittman and her just had a fabulous conversation about a month ago. So
yeah,
it's the debtcollective.org, I believe.
Yeah. Thank you, Jeremiah, for promoting that show. And of course, all of our APA shows are available on the archives, and you can find any and all of them. So we are kind of running late, Marjorie, and I do want to talk about the very important part, which is what are the solutions. So, and of course, we'll not get into a lot of what you're talking about, the seven myths and so on and so forth. But can and should the current system be reformed? And if not, what needs to be done?
I don't think that capitalism can really be reformed. We've been trying that for many decades, and things are getting worse rather than better. I think we need to move to a next system, a democratic economy. We need to let go of the idea that our choices are binary, that we have either capitalism or socialism. I think that we need what we call a democratic economy, and that includes public ownership and community ownership of vital sectors of the economy like healthcare and water, electricity. It includes worker ownership, I think, on a massive scale of enterprises, and there's already tax incentives in place for that, and retiring baby boom entrepreneurs. We could have a massive shift to worker ownership that would benefit all of us. You know, we need investments need to be serving the public good and not just, you know, maximizing returns. And there's a whole field of impact investing that's really proving how to do that. So, you know, we need we need debt forgiveness and not just reserve that for people like Trump, but ordinary people also need access to debt forgiveness when it's necessary. So yes, a democratic economy is a variety of models, cooperatives, community land trusts, co-housing. We own things together, ownership is broad-based, and capital itself is also serving life and not just extracting from it. We need an ecosystem of banking in the public interest. All these things have been worked out, and this is what I as a journalist and a theorist, I'm really drawing on the work of thousands of visionaries who have really worked out these various models. We know how to make a democratic economy. That's such exciting. I hope people will take a look at the book, Wealth Supremacy. I'm told it's pretty readable.
Yeah, I hope people do that too. And again, the name or the title of the book is Wealth Supremacy, How the Extractive Economy and the Biased Rules of Capitalism Drive Today's Crises. And the name of our guest is Marjorie Kelly. So speaking of Trump, Scott called while you were talking and he did not want to stay on the line, but he wanted to say that the bipartisan liberal support for this sort of policy, I suppose means the way wealth happens currently, might explain why a non-neoliberal candidate like Trump might have any working class support beyond the racism, which is also there, which I think, what do you think about this idea?
Well, I think that those of us who are working for system change or for a democratic economy, we need to get together and become a coherent movement, because I think Biden is doing more radical things than any recent Democratic president has done. He's done debt forgiveness, pulling the green energy transition. He's doing a lot of good things, but I think that we're still captive to neoliberal thinking, and that's true both Democrats and Republicans to a large extent. So we need to develop and cohere around, I think, what can be called a democratic economy, and really become a movement and bring these ideas into the mainstream. We're not there yet fully.
Yeah, no, we're definitely not there, and there are so many obstacles, I think, on the way to reaching it. But your chapter 13, in part 3, where we begin, is titled "Breaking the Trance: We Participate in System Change When We Change Our Minds." Explain what that means.
That's a really, I appreciate you bringing that up, because I think if it's a battle of power versus power, that we will lose. That really the ultimate power that we, the people, possess is legitimacy. I mean, think about what brought down Harvey Weinstein. It wasn't that all those women had power. It's that they were able to bring out public outrage at what he had done, moral outrage, because his behavior, you know, harassing all these women was not legitimate. And we need to recognize that our economy, its normal functioning, is not legitimate. It's rigged in favor of the wealthy few. And I think if we can get together and see that and help other people to see it so that we see it as not legitimate, that can really fuel deep change. So yes, I think seeing clearly what's happening, naming it as bias, which is what it is, I think that is a tremendous force. And it begins by by seeing. It begins by changing our mind, recognizing bias. I think that in itself is the foundation of system change.
Mm-hmm. And again, I kind of want to go further into how does that happen? How do we make that happen? What does a new economy, a different, better economy look like so that we can entice others with that thought?
Sure. Well, our organization, the Democracy Collaborative, is doing working with cities on local economic development in a way that we call community wealth building. And this is having communities own and control their own assets. And this is happening in St. Louis, Kansas City, Los Angeles, Chicago. It's happening all over. So community wealth building, this is where we're building the next economy at the local level. I encourage people to look into it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the book again is Wealth Supremacy, How the Extractive Economy and the Biased Rules of Capitalism Drive Today's Crisis. Our guest has been Marjorie Kelly. We are going to talk here with Ralph Nader about what's going on in Palestine. War makes a lot of money, doesn't it?
It does.
Yeah, there's a lot of good reasons for people who care only about money to have war, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Marjorie. I hope that people do get your book. And yeah, be well.
Thank you, Esty. It's been fun talking with you.
Thank you so much. And we are going to move straight to Ralph Nader. The name I know is familiar to you all. He has been a guest on this show. He is the author of many books, including Unsafe at Any Speed, The Designed In Dangers of the American Automobile, Unstoppable, the emerging left-right alliance to dismantle the corporate state, and most recently, The Rebellious CEO, 12 Leaders Who Did It Right. Hello, Ralph Nader. Thank you so very much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Good to have you. So you estimate that 200,000 Palestinians have been killed in Gaza. That's about seven times what we're hearing. What do you base this estimate on?
Well, if you look at past wars and bombings, the comparisons are quite grim for the people in Gaza. People should know that Gaza geographically is the size of Philadelphia. Philadelphia has 1.5 million people. Gaza has 2.3 million. Very crowded space. And the Israelis started on October 7th, after the Hamas raid, with the genocidal orders of its Ministry of Defense that they were going to go into Gaza with all the modern weaponry the U.S. has provided, compliments of the U.S. taxpayer as well, and that there was going to be, in the Minister of Defense's quotes, quote, no food, no water, no electricity, no fuel, no medicine, end quote. Then it was followed by 70,000 bombs and missiles that have destroyed whole apartment buildings, homes, marketplaces, refugee camps, hospitals, clinics, ambulances, bakeries, schools, mosques, churches, roads, electricity networks, critical water mains, just about everything. Because, you know, they claimed there's a Hamas fighter behind every olive tree, so they got to even destroy olive trees. Now, when you add that to the lack of medication, the lack of ambulances, the lack of health care, the lack of antiseptics, the killings of medical personnel, over 137 journalists killed by the Israeli bombs, over 165 UN UNRWA relief workers killed. In other words, disabling the entire area. You get the warnings that we're hearing all the time from the UN and Doctors Without Borders, that there are now infectious diseases spreading everywhere. People were already infirm and sick before October 7th, can't get their medicines for diabetics, for example, can't get their medicines. Cancer patients can't get their medicine. 5,000 babies are born every month. We're into our sixth month in Gaza, born into the rubble. The UN humanitarian spokesperson said that there were tens of thousands of bodies under the rubble, unrecoverable, and they're not being counted as well. So given all this destruction, deprivation, starvation, lack of clean water, dirty water leading to serious diarrhea and dysentery for children is fatal. Doctors know that from their experience everywhere. Now you add all this up, and we are led to believe that 98.5% of all the people in Gaza are still alive, and only 1.5% have lost their lives. Now, where does the estimate come from that the press is using? I might add, Esty, the progressive press is just as culpable as the mainstream. They all use now the 32,000 figure put out by Hamas's health ministry. Well, Hamas relied on names of the deceased from hospitals and morgues. Well, those have all been disabled or destroyed. So, but there's a more serious conflict here. This is where Netanyahu, who in the past bragged about supporting and helping to fund Hamas because it was opposed to a two-state solution, he bragged about that in 2018, 2019. So he's got that kind of burden on his political back. But he likes a low death toll. Why does Hamas have a low death toll? Because they don't want to be accused by their own people of not being able to protect them and have shelters and other resources against the massive genocidal destruction of Gaza. So that's where I came up with a 200,000 figure, and it's going higher by the hour. When you have starvation and little children not having anything to eat or having dirty water to ingest, the curve of fatalities goes up. Like, you can survive poor nutrition for 10 days, but 20 days, 30 days, the curve of fatalities going up. So these poor Palestinians, they can't flee because they're surrounded by a siege. They can't surrender. The Israelis don't want POWs. They just want the people they're abducting and turning into hostages in Israeli jails, which get very little attention compared to the Hamas-held hostages. These are thousands and thousands of people, many of them women and children, abducted in jail without charges, etc. That's well known. And you can't do all that and still keep them from even having an account of their dead. Whole extended families have been wiped out. 30, 50, 100, 130. On Al Jazeera and Amy Goodman and Progressive Radio. So this is a demand that we've made of Biden and the World Health Organization to start coming up with some reliable estimates of the reality of the fatalities and the tremendous number of injuries. Imagine the shrapnel injuries alone, never mind injuries from direct bombing, missiles, anti-tank, a tank, artillery, snipers. They have snipers killing people in hospitals. This is a complete out-of-control demonstration of Israeli state terror producing the Holocaust for the Palestinian people.
Yeah, I must say your number resonated with me. I don't know if we're talking 200,000 or what, but I've been watching with amazement as the numbers grow by, you know, maybe 100 per day kind of thing, when we know, or we should know, that at least 100 are killed by just bombing and sharpshooters and so on. And homes keep getting destroyed, and people keep being shepherded away, or not even shepherded, but you know, just thrown away from the places where they found a little bit of security. More people are under the rubble every day. How can it just can't be that the numbers have been hovering around 30,000 for what, at least 2-3 weeks now?
It's improbable. It's lethally improbable. Children are starving at the fastest rate.
Right.
The world has seen, according to aid groups. You talk to the doctors who are in these hospitals, or what's left of them, and the bodies are piled up. Stray dogs are eating the bodies.
Yeah.
This is a horrendous, devastating catastrophe that's going to plague the reputation of Israel for decades to come.
And of the United States.
And the United States.
Yeah.
Co-belligerent. Biden talking out of both sides of his mouth. One side is shipping all kinds of weapons by ship and air to the Israelis without any conditions, violating 5 federal laws, by the way, including the Leahy human rights condition law. These are criminal statutes. He doesn't care. And the other side of his mouth, he's saying, oh, Mr. Netanyahu, please keep the civilian casualties at a minimum. And he doesn't demand that 500-600 trucks ready to come into Gaza every day with food, medicine, water, and other necessities of life be allowed entry by the Israelis, who are blocking most of these trucks week after week after week. In fact, there are some high Israeli political officials who've openly said they want to ban any humanitarian aid in, which is, of course, a major war crime under the laws of war, which the Israelis are violating right and left.
Yeah,
so
how...
this is the Congress that is aiding and abetting this, the majority in Congress, all the Republicans, almost without any dissent, and even still a majority of Democrats, about to pass another $14 billion, with a B, of taxpayer money. We call it the genocide tax, to further supply more weaponry and pay for Israel's genocidal war. I mean, Israel has turned the U.S. government into the tail of the Israeli bull. It's just humiliating, because they're doing this all in the name of the American people, Biden and Blinken. It's humiliating to the U.S. government to be treated this way. And Netanyahu is on the verge of bypassing Biden, his greatest accolade, and directly speaking to Congress,
yeah,
which is an incredible breach of protocol. And he's done it before, a few years ago, when he circumvented Obama and directly addressed Congress. So he has far more support in Congress than he has in the Israeli Knesset. About 80% of the people want him out of there. A majority still want the war to be pursued, but they want him out of there, which is what led Senator Schumer to make his modest suggestion that Netanyahu, his old friend, has, quote, lost his way, end quote. And by the way, in terms of the fatality toll, Esti, 85% of the people in Gaza are living outside, under the elements. It's pretty cold. They've been driven from their homes. They've been told to flee to safe areas, and when they follow Israeli military orders, they get strafed and bombed. So this is savagery at an unparalleled level for a country that presumes to be observing international law. Can you imagine? They keep saying it while The Hague has established a plausible genocide case in order them to minimize civilian casualties. Instead, they are fueling the evidence for the genocide case before the International Court of Justice in The Hague.
Yeah, you actually mentioned the December 29, 2023 opinion piece in The Guardian by the chair of global public health at the University of Edinburgh, Devi Sridhar, who predicted that 500,000 deaths will happen in 2024 if conditions continue unabated. That's, again, from December, from the end of last year. Yeah.
That's right. Half a million. And they're not going to all die in December 2024. They're dying day by day at an alarmingly accelerated rate. 16 Israeli human rights organizations have put out in the New York Times in late December an open letter to Biden on the human catastrophe of Gaza. Think of the courage.
Yeah.
These are refuseniks, rabbis for human rights. The lead sponsor of the letter was the famous B'Tselem, Israeli human rights group. Think of the pressure on them to keep quiet, but they will not keep quiet any more than Jewish Voice for Peace in this country, and if not now in this country, are not keeping quiet.
Yeah.
So the Palestinian rights advocates, the anti-genocide advocates, are controlling the streets in our country, but the Israeli lobby here is controlling the suites, the Congress, and the White House. But they're feeling the heat, and it's going to be a major election issue if Joe Biden doesn't dramatically suspend weapons, get a ceasefire, and pour those hundreds of trucks in as fast as possible and reinstate the funding for UNRWA. Can you imagine suspending the funding for the main relief agency under the UN for the last half century for the Palestinian poor, impoverished, and sick? And Biden did that. That's what Netanyahu wanted him to do. You know, in 1996, President Eisenhower saw Israeli, French, and British fighter planes attacking Egypt because its leader, Nasser, had just announced the nationalization of the Suez Canal as Egyptian property, which is now widely accepted. And Eisenhower stood up and he told the British, French, and Israelis, you're going to stop this attack and you're going to stop it now.
Yeah.
And they did.
Yeah.
That's the last time a president of the United States stood up for American interests when it comes to what Israel's doing in the Middle East.
And that can be done. It can be done in a day. But, Ralph, we have only about 2 minutes left, so I want to ask you also about what you wrote about presidential debates and the possibility that we won't have them this year. I know you have a lot to say, but you have 2 minutes.
Yeah, very, very quickly. The Presidential Debate Commission has scheduled 3 presidential debates between Trump and Biden. The problem is that Trump and the GOP have dropped out last April, so there's not going to be any presidential debates. That leaves open debates in 6 cities and 6 swing states if the mayors and League of Women Voters and Urban League and unions and others, Chamber of Commerce, and who doesn't want a presidential debate in their city? Las Vegas, Phoenix, Philadelphia, Atlanta, Detroit, and Milwaukee.
Yeah.
So we sent this proposal to the mayors, including the mayor of Milwaukee, Professor Joel Rogers of University of Wisconsin Law School, has contacted the mayor's office. I hope John Nichols, who writes for your local Madison newspaper and The Nation magazine, will do the same. And I hope he'll return calls, which he doesn't do very often when I call him.
Same
this
here.
It's a great opportunity for local people to ask really tough questions of these presidential candidates. And they won't dare not show up because, you know, those states are going to decide the election. And you have all kinds of people in the cities from all backgrounds saying, we want you here on the stage after the conventions. So I hope that people listening to this program will contact the mayor's office in Milwaukee and will generate civic group demands to have Trump and Biden come to Milwaukee as well as to the other cities.
Yeah.
It could change the dynamics. It could change the kind of agendas and issues that are discussed. It can get more votes out. It can excite young students in the classes talking about the election with their teachers. There's no downside. So it's just a matter of the civic community, labor unions, Chamber of Commerce, and others to put out an invitational committee to these candidates and get them to their cities.
I'm glad, Ralph, that you put it out to our listeners. Thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate hearing from you. Ralph Nader, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you, Esty.
And thanks to Samuel and Jade and Shelly and Rick. I'm Esty Dinor. We'll be talking again next week. Thank you again. Bye-bye.
WORTFM Madison.
I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't. I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't. So good, so good. I got a year. Wow, I feel nice. A sugar and spice. I feel nice. A sugar and spice.
Well, good afternoon. Welcome to the Mel and Floyd Summer Replacement Show. I'm Mel. Floyd is on assignment, but with us, as always, the man who knows everything, Mr. Smarty Pants.
Howdy.
Hey.
I'm suffering from limp mic syndrome.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you're not as young as you used to be.
I keep trying to adjust the darn thing, and it just keeps flopping down here. There we go. All right. No, it's doing it again. All right. Oh dear. Yeah, anyway, yeah, on we go.
That's good
on,
radio.
Onward and upward. Yeah, well, you know.
So I've got to warn you.
Oh, okay.
And right after the show, I'm leaving for my annual lacrosse retreat.
Oh, are you?
With my old buddies.
Okay.
So I'm phoning this show in. I'm on vacation.
Let's see if the listener can tell the difference.
Yeah, probably not. But I'm already on vacation.
Cola A or Cola B? You're already on vacation. Well, you look pretty vacation-y, actually. Yeah, I look at you. You look very rest